Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hippie Witch, magic for a new age. I'm your host, Joanna DeVoe, and this is a happy, hippie place where magic with a K meets the law of attraction. Thanks for joining me for episode. Oh, no. We're off to a great start this morning. Thanks for joining me for episode 4 of Hippie Witch, Magic for a New Age. This episode is all about guilt, fear, and responsibility, the ethics of magic. And it was inspired by a couple of things. The first is that I hear quite a bit of fear-mongering in the witchy community about how you'd better be careful what you wish for because you just might get it, and then some. And I think that "and then some" is the important part. A popular example given, which I find extremely morbid and right up there with "you will burn in hell forever," is that if you do a spell to bring a large sum of money into your life, you may get it, but at what price? One of your beloved relatives could die in order for you to receive an inheritance, thus granting you your greedy little wish with an ironic slap in the face. Fun, huh? I really don't see too much of this mentality in the law of attraction community because it really goes against the teachings of people like Abraham Hicks, Teal Scott, and Sanaya Roman, which is where I think most people are getting the bulk of their information. But I was recently introduced to the work of a woman that really blows my mind, and I'm not going to name her here because she's a writer and a lecturer, but I'm just seriously so impressed by and in gratitude for the work that she's done in researching the origins of the law of attraction that I don't want to be disrespectful. This woman who calls herself a witch, by the way, for all her research has come to an entirely different conclusion about practicing the law of attraction, and more specifically, the secret's kind of superficial take on the law of attraction. And her opinion and subsequent warnings are more in line with what I was saying about the witches who warn about inadvertently bumping off your poor grandma when all you wanted was some fast cash to get yourself out of debt. So like an example she gives is you shouldn't do a love spell. Don't do a love spell, or don't do a spell to like make yourself super attractive and sexy, because you could inadvertently attract a bunch of unwanted suitors or a stalker or even rape. You might get raped if you do a spell to make yourself more attractive. And I think that is very extreme. And gosh, even just saying that, it kind of reminds me of like, well, she asked for it. Look what she was wearing. And I know that ought to like scare off the masses and keep this precious secret safe in the hands of the people who actually know what they're doing, which really for me just begs the question, who gets to decide who can handle these seductive but oh so dangerous powers? According to such and such book by this almighty and very important sounding alchemist from the 15th century, only someone who has been properly initiated into the ways of the initiate by someone who's been initiated by someone who's been initiated. Who initiated that original person? I'm guessing it was another mere mortal. Men wrote these books and made these rules. And no matter how cool and seemingly sacred these books may be, they are not the final word on magic. You know, we have a long history of superstition as humans, and especially if you're going to go pulling old, you know, sacred texts out of the rubble and quoting them as if they are, you know, the end-all, be-all word of God, I think you have to look at what else people were preaching around that time. And just as I believe that we created God in our image rather than the other way around, I believe that we make up these rules as reflections of our own fears and shadow beliefs. I think that these kind of fear-based conclusions can only be gotten to by an intellectual approach or from the outside, looking in. sorry, guys, my voice is a little wobbly. Maybe I should have done some, like, warm-up exercises first. The law of attraction, like magic, it's something that you have to practice and experience for yourself to fully understand. And I'm just a big proponent of letting experience be your guide. In my experience, nothing bad has ever happened to me or anyone that I know by practicing the law of attraction. In fact, only good has come from it, which even at its most basic level, you know, of an improved mood is pretty damn cool. I'm a person that believes that energy begets energy, so that would mean that love begets love, money begets money, a smile begets another smile, and it really just outlines the fact. For me, it's a fact. You may agree to disagree with me, but I believe in an abundant universe. And a really simple way to test this theory out is one day when you're feeling lethargic and extremely low on energy, instead of taking a nap or chugging a big old cup of coffee, force yourself to do a bunch of jumping jacks and karate kicks and, you know, like the funky chicken dance around your living room for a few minutes, or better yet, go outside and take a brisk walk around the neighborhood. And then afterward, you will notice that you are feeling very clear-headed and full of energy. All of a sudden, you feel energetic. But what happened to those feelings you had of being out of energy only, you know, a few short minutes ago? It's kind of interesting to think about. You just demonstrated to yourself that energy does, in fact, beget energy, which is a basic tenet of the law of attraction. And now I realize I'm getting way ahead of myself in talking about basic tenets. When I still haven't told you the second thing that prompted me to do this episode. The second thing that inspired this show was an email that I received from a friend, which I think echoes a concern that so many of us who have been successfully practicing the law of attraction for a while, we might find ourselves bumping up against. And she wrote this. I had gotten so deep in with asking for things, for manifesting things into my life, and it continued to work again and again. And with each new thing, I realized I have to be responsible for what I get. So that freaked me out, and I've been kind of stuck there ever since. Not only do I have to deal with the consequences of the things, people, and situations I manifest, but what if my life is on a certain track now because I have created it without the co, if that makes any sense? Of course, I do believe all is in divine order, yet I worry that I'm being punished for trying to make things happen. So that's what she had to say, and I think it's just representative of how a lot of us feel, and that it's actually three related but separate issues. It's feelings of unworthiness, fear of responsibility, and then a kind of manifestor's survival guilt. So I will address each of those things individually, even though they definitely play off and work together. The first thing is feelings of unworthiness. You know, she said, I worry I'm being punished for trying to make things happen. And that's what I like to refer to as the old Christian guilt. And I definitely have suffered from that in my lifetime, and I still do from sometime, you know, from time to time. And I've heard people refer to that as Catholic guilt. It probably, you know, applies to all God-fearing religions, so no doubt there's plenty of Jewish guilt out there, which, you know, these feelings of guilt, it creates a residual effect that can last well into our adulthood, these feelings of guilt that are implanted in us as kids. In fact, most of us end up passing that guilt onto our children and our children's children, and then finally taking that guilt all the way to the grave, because that's the power of programming. That's the power of belief. Abraham Hicks says, man has distorted who he thinks God is. In such extraordinary ways, he has turned God into an out-of-the-vortex judgmental being. I would argue with you that God is isn't even a being to begin with. Well, not like an anthropomorphized human-like being, but I do believe in source energy, which I often just refer to as the universe. Sometimes I use the word God because, you know, old habits die hard. And you could just as easily call that energy God. At any rate, it's interesting to me that we have projected our own judgmental nature onto God, and that we then, in turn, fear that he is going to punish us for our so-called sins. I know there is and has been for quite a while a movement happening in which people are redefining their idea of God and coming up with a much more loving, benevolent figure than the one so many of us were presented with as kids. And I think that's awesome. More of that, please. Marianne Williamson talks about God a lot, but her version of God is based on the teachings of A Course in Miracles and is much friendlier. She wrote a passage toward the beginning of her book, A Return to Love. It's a great, beautiful book, even if you don't believe in God. If you can just, you know, replace the word God with the universe, you could get a lot out of reading that book. But anyway, she says, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine, as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us. It's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. That's a long passage, I know, but I just had to share it with you. It's a quote that gets thrown around a lot, and I'm willing to bet that you've probably heard it before, but I don't mind repeating it because there's just a lot of power there and a lot to chew on and think about. It can be very moving upon hearing it for the first time because I think it holds within it the kind of truth that resonates deeply within the soul. Or we might just be moved by it because it's just such a relief from what it is that we've come to believe. Belief is very powerful, and you can hold old beliefs and programming so deeply in your subconscious mind that you don't even know it's there most of the time. Money, for most of us, is a great example of this. If you're a person who, despite your best efforts, continually finds yourself in a state of financial lack, it can really pay to excavate and examine the messages you were presented with as a child around money. I mean, did you hear things like, money is the root of all evil? It is harder for a rich man to get into heaven than it is for a camel to get through an eye of a needle. That's one that really blew my mind as a kid. Rich people are greedy and selfish, maybe even crooks and liars. They cheat on their taxes and exploit the poor. Maybe you believe that there's not enough to go around so that in your experience of an exceptional level of abundance, you are somehow creating an exceptional level of lack for someone else. So money is a topic that I will definitely get into in the future. But for now, I just want to say that if you are creating abundance in your life by doing what you love while genuinely being of service to others, is that not for the good of all? I mean, especially if you turn around and then invest part of your accrued power and earned income into supporting others to do the same. Jack Canfield, the creator of Chicken Soup for the Soul, says that you deserve to have anything that the universe has to offer as long as you don't hurt anyone in the process of getting it, which sounds a heck of a lot to me, like the often repeated, you know, witchy maxim of do what ye will, harm ye none. So, you know, do what ye will, harm ye none. And I don't think that in doing what you will be harming anyone if you are coming from a place of love and of being of service. I think that indulging feelings of unworthiness is absolutely a form of harm, though. That's one way to look at it. If you're a person that wants to harm none, you are harming yourself when you indulge in feelings of unworthiness. Not that you're indulging them. I guess that's, you know, making it sound like you're just loving it and just rolling around in it. But you can learn to not have feelings of unworthiness. And that's, you know, that's a whole process. That's not something that you just, you know, snap your fingers and all of a sudden you feel worthy. You definitely have to make the effort over time. But in feeling unworthy, you're harming yourself. And again, that's why I always say it's important to do your shadow work. It all comes back to shadow work. And I'm going to have to schedule an episode on that soon. But in the meantime, you can go to the sidebar of my website and find a bunch of videos and blog posts that I've done on that subject. Lots of good stuff on shadow work there and how it applies to the law of attraction. I once heard Abraham Hicks describe worthiness as being in alignment with who you really are. So if that's true, then feelings of unworthiness are in a kind of roundabout way. They're kind of like your friends. They're like little action signals telling you that you are out of alignment and reminders that the choice is yours to get back in. Since you are a vibrational being and emotion is your point of attraction, you know, those feelings, they let you know. Emotion lets you know what you are currently attracting into your life. And if that's not a match with what you desire, it lets you know that you need to make a little adjustment. The law of attraction brings you a match of what you are and of what you are currently vibrating in the moment. So whatever emotion you are feeling now is an indicator of what you will be experiencing next. So I guess if you're afraid, you should be afraid, because in your being afraid, you are drawing to you what it is you are afraid of. I know that's like a crazy way to think of it, but it's kind of true. And it's also really cool because it means that if you're aware, you can turn that shit around. Have you ever heard the saying that worry is praying for what you don't want? I love that, and that's something that I definitely like to keep in mind when it comes to these kind of things. And anyway, I could just keep going down this rabbit hole forever and ever and give example after example, but this show is still only 30 minutes long, and I have to move on. I want to make the show longer. I'm still, like, in this test phase and getting used to talking live here to you guys, so bear with me in these beginning episodes. And I thank you again for listening to me and all the nice messages you've sent me. I really appreciate the support because this actually makes me kind of nervous. Okay, number two, fear of responsibility. This is something that I have spent a lot of time wrestling around with in my own life. And in my younger years, besides taking care of my son without managing to burn the house down, I was extremely irresponsible. And really, someone even just mentioning the word responsibility kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I think for me, it was just like a fear of growing up. I didn't want to grow up, and I certainly didn't want to be alone in the world fending for myself. I wanted to be taken care of. But what I eventually came to realize, and I'm still, you know, trying to wrap my head around, is that Prince Charming isn't coming. And I have no choice but to, you know, kind of be the captain of my own ship and take responsibility for my own life. And, you know, this can, it can be a scary prospect, but when we take responsibility for our lives, I think, you know, magic happens. And I think it's really just the prospect of it that is scary. It's that, you know, fear that, you know, we won't be able to blame anyone else for the circumstances we find ourselves. You know, there's no one to blame but ourselves kind of thing. And you can't go around saying, look what he did to me. Lori Cabot says in The Witch in Every Woman, which I've been reading lately, and I just love this book. She says that exhibiting even a little control over your life implies a degree of responsibility. We all like to think that things just happen, Being a witch means accepting responsibility for your own innate strengths and abilities. And, I mean, really the theme of that whole book, which is why I like it, is that if you're going to call yourself a witch, you are declaring yourself a sovereign, and you are accepting responsibility for your life and really the ability to co-create your life, as I talk about. She doesn't use that kind of wording, but really fits together nicely. You know, she says the first thing, you know, in order to call yourself a witch, the first thing you must accept is that you have to take complete responsibility for what it is you are creating in your life. And I like to break the word responsibility down into two words, because I told you I really don't like it very much. It's just like, ugh, this is a word that rubs me the wrong way. Discipline is another one of those words. But I like to break it down into response and ability. And then all of a sudden, it's like much friendlier. It's the ability to respond, and looked at it like that, it's just a much easier pill for me to swallow. Responsibility, the ability to respond. Will you have the ability to respond? Will you have the ability to respond to the demands of the career, relationship, of your dreams, the demands that that might present? Will you be able to respond to the necessary management of the mountains of cash you say you desire? Will you feel overwhelmed, overextended, burnt out, sorry that you asked for too much? Will you be able to handle or navigate the resulting manifestations of your desire? I don't know. Christians often say that God won't give you more than you can handle, you know, and even, you know, non-Christians, people will just say that to you when you're feeling really overwhelmed by life, and that can actually be kind of an irritating thing to hear when life is really sucking for you. But maybe you don't need to give yourself more than you can handle. You know, you don't have to eat the entire sandwich in one gulp. You can just take, you know, one little bite at a time, little bits. Chew it up, enjoy the flavor, you know, and then when you're ready to move on, you can take another bite. And one last point I want to make before I move on is kind of about co-creation. I think accepting responsibility is not an excuse to indulge in self-blame when things don't go your way. You know, maybe you didn't do the spell right. Maybe you weren't in proper alignment, as Abraham Hicks says. You know, if you accept that this is a co-creation, this life, and that you're creating with God or the universe or some mysterious force, and that maybe, you know, if you can accept that, then maybe, just maybe, it was not for the good of all what it was you were trying to create, and maybe it was not for the good of you. Maybe something even better than what you had imagined for yourself is on its way, or perhaps, you know, some kind of disaster was averted. So, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why I like to say co-creating. You know, so not everyone agrees with that, too. I just want to add. I know, I think like Teal Scott thinks that you alone are creating your own reality. And maybe that's true. But for me, it just works better and helps me to, you know, accept and roll with, you know, the punches of life a little bit easier to think I'm co-creating it. But maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. That's just my perception. And then finally, number three is what I am calling manifestor's survivor's guilt. And I just made that up. But, you know, survivor's guilt is when someone is in a horrible accident and people die or they get really badly hurt. Sometimes the survivors, the people who don't get hurt, they carry a kind of guilt with them into the future, and they feel bad, like, why did this happen to them and it didn't happen to me? And I think we can kind of feel that way when we start practicing the law of attraction and we start manifesting all this good stuff into our lives, and we maybe feel like we're leaving our friends and family behind, or that we're somehow taking more than our share. But I believe, and again, this is just my belief, I share it with many others, but I believe in an abundant universe. And the Buddha has a really great quote about this. It's very profound. Thousands of candles can be lighted from a single candle, and the life of the candle will not be shortened. That's just like a beautiful piece of imagery. A great thing to think about, you know, your candle, you could light a sea of candles based on one little match. So I think that's just another beautiful example of energy begets energy, and that this is an abundant universe. Another thing that I've learned from Abraham Hicks, again, I'm going to throw that name around a lot here, that really demonstrates my take on this universe as an abundant one and reiterates the fact that you don't have to make yourself smaller to make room for someone else's abundance, is when Abraham says, you know, jokingly, I've actually heard this a couple times, we never hear you say, well, I've been feeling well for so long that I think I'm going to be sick for a while so that more people can be well. Because that's just kind of silly. There is well-being, and you're either letting that in or not. And whether they are letting that in or not has nothing to do with you. Teal Scott in Sculptor in the Sky says something similar. She says, the universe is not one of finite size. It is infinite, which means you cannot get poor enough to make someone else rich, and you cannot suffer enough to make someone else happy. She also says that the best way to help others is to realize that you can't help others. All you can really do is find your bliss, and then from there, those who are in a receptive state can help themselves up using that. And I know I'm throwing a lot of quotes around, but I wrote some really good ones down for you guys. William Blake once said, if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. Love that. So really, I think the best thing you can do for other people is to thrive, to really thrive physically, mentally, and emotion, because our feelings are contagious. And two examples of this that immediately spring to mind, as many people who hate someone like Oprah Winfrey or even Marie Forleo, who's a popular business guru online, for as many people as are turned off by that kind of positivity and striving, there are many, many more people who are striving to rise to the occasion and who are inspired by that and making their lives better because those women exist. And when you take one step forward, you take a step forward for the rest of us. As Neil Armstrong said when he became the first human being to walk on the moon, that's one small step for a man, one giant leap forward for mankind. And I'm running out of time. Holy cow, there's so much more I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about the 4-minute mile and how it was first achieved in 1954 by Roger Bannister. It was believed that it was not possible for anyone to run a 4-minute mile, and he proved them wrong, and he ran a 4-minute mile. And now many, 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 many other runners have not only run a 4-minute mile, they have run a mile in a faster, shorter time period, and now it's been cut down almost 17 seconds shorter than that. So, once you break that barrier, it breaks it for everyone, and everyone can run through. My sister's a runner. She just shocked the crap out of me by telling me that she was going to run 50 miles on purpose for fun. But apparently, people like her, she's been a runner her whole life. They have been, running these marathons, and they've run so many marathons, they're ready for the next challenge, and they're ready to raise that bar higher. So now they're running these things called mega marathons, and she did it. She ran 50 miles. So she's raising that bar for other runners and showing what is possible. Who knows what they'll be doing in 100 years from now. And I also just want to circle back to mentioning Oprah Winfrey and Marie Forleo as examples, in saying that these are women who have not only made the world a better place by being excellent and continually striving for more, and that they, inspire others to be excellent and strive for more, but these are also women who pay it back, who share their wealth. Oprah with her Girls Academy and the Angel Network and any number of charitable donations, and Marie with her, she donates to Kiva, I know, a part of her proceeds, which provides microloans for women-owned businesses all around the world. So there you have two perfectly fine examples of how taking more for yourself, you're not necessarily taking from others. In fact, in many cases, you are giving to them, providing financial support or just good old-fashioned encouragement. And I've run out of time to talk about the never-ending story. I posted a really cool little clip in the comments section or in the description, so you can go and watch that if you want. But I'll have to talk about that some other time. Next week, I will talk about the magically magnetic power of the heart chakra, which is your point of attraction. I'm really excited to talk about that. Go watch that clip. If you've ever seen The Neverending Story, I think it's an amazing spiritual movie. It's got all these cool lessons. And at the end, which is what that clip is at the very end of the movie. So if you've seen it, it'll be a nice reminder of what we're talking about here. And if you haven't seen it, it's a spoiler. So maybe you want to see the whole movie and save that clip for another time. Much love. Peace.